This is KPOO, San Francisco, by my baby!
Shibba shibba! Shibba shibba! Shibba shibba!
Let me in!
Shibba shibba!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shibba shibba!
Open up your soul!
Shibba shibba!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your mind.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello. And welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. As you know, every month I have a scintillating scientist on to talk about their area of expertise, and it's always interesting. Even when you think it's going to be crazy, you're just like, oh, I had no idea it could be that fun. And I would say that because I didn't have a very good science background, so I get really excited when the scientists come on. So I'm super excited today. We are going to talk to Mila Pamplona Barbosa. Welcome.
Hi. It's so nice to be here.
It's nice
Thank
to
you
have
for
you.
Having me.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for coming on down to the station. So before we get into your area of expertise, let's talk about when did you discover that you really enjoyed the sciences?
Okay. I think this is a kind of funny story because my mom is also a biologist. I'm a biologist.
Oh, very cool.
And as a kid, I loved science because she would always explain me a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was really cool. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to do science. And my parents would be like, no, you're going to be a doctor. And I was like, no, I want to be a different type of doctor.
Wait a minute. So your mom, who's a biologist, looks down on biology as a step?
Yeah.
Wow.
That happened.
That's hilarious. Okay. So they're telling you're going to be a doctor. And
you're
like, I'm not having it.
Yeah. And then my parents used to do a lot of volunteer work. Mm-hmm. They still do a lot. But I remembered at the time they were working in a literacy project for adults. Mm-hmm. And I used to, this was in the rural area in Brazil. So I used to go there and play with the kids while my parents were teaching. And those kids, I remember when we were starting playing, at some point they didn't realize what was science. They never heard about a university, because they didn't have the same opportunities as I had. Mm-hmm. So from that moment on, I feel like becoming a scientist became not only something that I really want to do, but something that I felt like I had to do because I have the opportunities for it.
Uh-huh.
And this is something that stay with me. I was 8 years old. And
wow.
Since then, that's been the dream.
I'm fascinated by that at such a young age, you understood what a huge disparity there was between you and other people. You understood why it was there.
Yeah.
And you took that as sort of a mandate to be that all you can be. Why do you think you were able to see it that way as opposed to, as you get older, kind of just, I'm just going to do what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think, how do you think, why?
I think it comes a lot from my background because my family, it's very social and community driven.
Mm-hmm.
They've been in politics. They've been running church stuff, so many different things. And the fact, I remember that it really pissed me off at the time when I realized that, oh my God, those kids, we could have a genius here that could solve a lot of problems of the world, but they don't have access to education.
Mm-hmm.
So we're never gonna explore that. And then I started thinking a lot about this and I was like, no, I can do this. So I want to do this. And also, I was really passionate about science in general. I love complicated things.
Okay.
I feel trying to understand how things work. And nature, I think, is just so amazing. So it's always something that spoke a lot to me.
Okay. Yeah. So you make this decision pretty early on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that laser-like focus taking you all the way through, or were there detours, before you got to college? Because, everyone goes through their teen years. And
yeah. I think I really wanted, like, I started speaking, like, more loudly that I really want to be a scientist around 13, because I told my parents that I want to move to São Paulo to study in the University of São Paulo, which is kind of the biggest research university in Brazil.
Okay.
And I'm from a small town in the state of Bahia, so we didn't even have universities at the time there, so we really had to move to, like, a capital, a bigger city to do that. Now they have, but when I was there, they didn't. Mm-hmm. And my parents were like, this is insane. São Paulo is, like, such a big city. You're not going there. My baby's not going there.
Are you an only child?
I have three older siblings.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm the baby because, like, I'm the youngest.
Okay, so you're the baby.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's why you have that tenacity, because the youngest is like, I'm doing what I want to do.
Yes. So we, at that time, they were saying no. And at some point, everyone was pressuring so much for me to go to med school. In Brazil, it's a little bit different. So you don't, like, get to college and then you choose what you want to do, like your major.
Mm-hmm.
You choose, like, from the very start. And I really wanted to go with biology or physics or something like this. Uh-huh. That was, like, my biggest thing, like, what kind of science I want to do.
Yeah.
But I really wanted at the time study neurosciences.
Mm-hmm.
So my family was pressuring me to go to med school, because then I could, like, if I didn't want to do science, I could be a doctor and, like, I will have resources and things like this.
Okay.
So I even, I got into med school and my parents were super happy.
Yeah.
And it was kind of an accident, because of, like, the system that they have to apply, you need to choose courses. And I was like, huh, the biology, like, universities that I wanna, they're not in the system. I'm going to put, like, med school. I don't care. Uh-huh. And then I got in, so I was like, oh my God, I have to go to med school.
Right, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah. And then I tried to go. Like, I remember that I enrolled. My dad was super proud. Like, he traveled to go with me to enroll, like, all this stuff. And then a few weeks later, I got the results from University of São Paulo in biology. And then I called my mom and my dad. I was like, okay, I'm already dropping out of med school. So it was very chaotic.
I can imagine that conversation.
Yeah, no one was happy about it. I have a sibling that dropped off law school, and he's the oldest. So he was like, you don't want to see her doing the same thing. It was like a huge kind of fight in the family.
Right.
But my parents, they supported me. They were like, I think you're making a dumb choice, but I'm going to let you make it, because that's your life. And then they did it. And when I got into Stanford and I moved here, my dad was like, you're right all along, right?
Wow, because like, they know Stanford, because Stanford's a prestigious university.
All over the world.
Right.
So they were really excited about it.
Okay. Is it more prestigious than the med school that you got accepted to?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Wow. Okay. So it's good. It's good for you that you got accepted. So now they're on board?
Oh, 100%. Now they're super excited that are always, like, trying to find common ground regarding not only biology, like climate change, and also, like, the animals that I study, because I really like animal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's sweet, because my parents are always like, okay, and now I'm going to study frogs, but I spend five to seven years studying ants.
Uh-huh.
So every time they would see something related to ants, my dad would be like, hey, Mila, and send me that. So it's very supportive. I think it's very cute.
Do you think that maybe part of the reason why your brother dropped out of law school is because it wasn't his choice to begin with?
Yeah, it's kind of funny, because he didn't want to necessarily go to law school. He wanted to study, like, movies, like cinema.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But at that time, there were, like, no courses available that were, like, from a public university, because that's the system in Brazil. Like, a lot of times people who have more resources, they study in private schools, and then they get into the public university because the public university is very good.
Okay.
So, I mean, almost everyone in my family that had this pathway, we had a lot of resources, so we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother, he did this, but eventually he dropped out because he was like, I hate this.
Sure.
And then he became a journalist. So he's a journalist. He studies, like, a lot of things related to movies, too. Mm-hmm. Like, he does shorter commentaries and stuff like this. So
you said you have three older siblings?
Or? Yeah.
Okay. So did your parents have something mapped out for each and every one of you, or just like you were the doctor, oldest was supposed to be a lawyer, and the middle two were just like, we're doing whatever we want to do?
No. It's funny, because the oldest one, he went to law school, but then he switched to to journalism. The other one, he went to law school and he loved law school. Like,
oh, okay.
He's a great lawyer.
Okay.
And my sister, she was like, I want to be a doctor, but she was not sure. So she got into biology, mm-hmm. and also like nutrition, like as a course. And she started taking all the common courses in nutrition for med school because she was going to ask for a transfer, mm-hmm. and she hated them. So she ended up just being a biologist too. So we have three biologists in the family.
Wow. I love that. I really. So, okay. So fast forward, you get into Stanford, and what's the first thing that fascinates you when you get to Stanford about in the sciences? Because I don't think you go directly into to the neurophysiology. Mm-hmm. So what was the pathway?
Yeah, I think my pathway, especially going to Stanford, started mm-hmm. at University of São Paulo, mm-hmm. where I did undergrad research. And that's the moment that I think I found my passion and my love. That's when I had my first classes about biological rhythms, circadian rhythms, uh-huh. this kind of stuff. I just absolutely love it. Like, I remember that I had the class and I cried because I'm like, this is pretty science.
Wow.
I love this.
So you're sitting in the lecture hall, and what is the professor saying that is making your heart speed up like that?
Yeah. I think, as I mentioned, like, I love how things are connected, mm-hmm. and I really like the idea of trying to unravel how things work.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about circadian rhythms, it's because they combine different areas. Mm-hmm. So
now, some of our listeners might not know what circadian rhythms are.
Yes. So, like, what are circadian rhythms? Basically, during evolution, we had the cycles, environmental cycles, that mm-hmm. repeat all the time. So they're very predictable. Like, we have the day and the night, we have mm-hmm. the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the organisms, the way that they evolved, they ended up creating ways to anticipate that.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, like, if you leave like a plant in the dark for several days, they still, like, the leaves are still gonna open when mm-hmm. it's supposed to be sunny mm. and close during the night,
mm-hmm.
because this is the kind of system the body knows. It's like your own clock. So when we talk about circadian rhythms, we're talking about the circadian clock that all organisms have, like from bacteria to us, everything has it. And it's super important to control their physiology.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk about the way that it connects things, like, it's related to the physiology because it helps setting up like your hormones, like your behavior when you're sleeping, when you're not, when you're hungry, when you're not. So all these little things. And it also interacts a lot with the ecology, like the environment outside, because the resources change, the cues in the environment mm-hmm. also change. And mm-hmm. you have to, like, adequate that so you can survive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when I saw that, I was like, this is beautiful. It combines everything that I think it's lovely about biology. So,
and that's just the first day?
Yeah, that kind of happened. Yeah.
Wow.
Also, like, one of my favorite professors was the one teaching it.
Okay.
So I think that also spoke to me a lot.
Well, give that professor a shout out.
Yeah, she's amazing. Her name is Gisele Oda, and she was also my... one of my advisors during undergrad research.
Okay. So you're doing, I'm assuming, multiple research projects.
Yeah.
And then at what point do you go, ants, it's always been ants and it will continue to be ants until the end of time?
Yeah, it's funny that you say it like this because it just switched. It's not ants anymore for a while.
Oh, okay.
But I love animal behavior mm-hmm. and I love circadian rhythm. So to me, it really speaks when I think about different organisms that can help us understand different questions.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started working with ants, this professor, I came to her. I was like, oh, I want to study circadian rhythms. And she was like, okay, Mila, I know you and I don't think you should work with me. And I was like, what? And then she was like, Mila, you don't like vertebrates. I work like with mammals.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, that's true. And she was like, I think you need to figure out something. I'm going to co-advise you, but let's find an environment that's going to be best for you.
Okay.
Like, so I ended up being co-advised in a cognition sciences lab. So a lot of people were studying hardcore neurosciences, and like with attention, memory, this kind of thing. And the other part of the lab was studying ants' behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically leaf cutter ants. So they're the coolest. I'm sorry, everyone that likes ants. They're the coolest.
Okay.
And so I studied them for a while, and we had this opportunity to like investigate some questions related to their behavior mm-hmm. and how they organize themselves according to time.
Okay.
So basically, like, this lab was starting to create a software to watch ants and count ants.
Oh, okay.
And that will allow us to, like, monitor their behavior in large scale. Because I don't know if you've ever seen, like, a leafcutter ant colony. Maybe.
They have them at the Academy of Sciences.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so they have one there, and it's really pretty. But it's still a small one, honestly, because, like, in nature, they can reach to 8 million individuals.
Wow.
So we're talking about this massive, gigantic cities full of ants, and they're all organizing themselves.
And how big is a colony? How much space does a colony of 8 million take up?
It can go up to like 7 to 8 meter down.
Okay. Like a high-rise building for
ants.
Yeah,
it's really big. Like, there are some videos on YouTube that I highly recommend for people to watch if you look like digging up a leafcutter and leafcutter nest, something like this, you're gonna find it. And it's huge. Like, the people, they put cement, so then they excavate everything, and it's like this huge city, and it's so much bigger than people. It's
okay.
insane. Like, okay. I think it's really cool. When you look at this, you're like, oh my God, we really, I feel like we as humans, as a species, we oversell what we can do, but we, a lot of times, we don't pay attention to what other animals are doing, other organisms, because they can be pretty amazing. So that fascinates me a lot.
Well, I gotta say, just yesterday, actually, I was thinking about humans and how we're really not that much different from ants. We're constantly building things. And, you know, ants communicate, I believe, through scent, and we communicate through words. But, you know, is there really any difference?
Yeah, I mean, of course there are differences because we're different species, but there's a lot of things that we have in common. So they are, we can call them like social animals because the society is really important for us as humans. Our evolution really, like, being in social groups also was crucial for that to happen. They have a very clear division of tasks. We also kind of have a division of tasks. And also we also divide like the work of like taking care of like the our babies. And it's kind of what the ants do too. So there's a lot of similarities. And I think there's a lot of things that we can compare, like the complexity. There's a lot of, for example, a lot of mathematical models that use machine learning trying to count people, for example, in the street.
Okay.
They can also be used for ants. And when you look at the patterns of locomotion, they're pretty similar.
In what way?
Basically, like, we aggregate in a way in the way that we walk around, kind of chaotic, but it's still organized.
Right.
It's kind of very similar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you look at a big colony, like, I, as a just a normal person, just think of ants as just blanket ants. But when you look at them carefully, do you see personalities emerging, or like, do you see like some groups like cliques forming, or beefs, or personality, like individual ant things?
Yeah. Personality is always like a hard topic when we talk about animals. So I like to acknowledge that before I say anything.
Sure.
But I do believe that they have personality.
Okay.
But anyway, so one thing that is really important is that the ants, when they divide the labor, some tasks can be associated as different types of ants. For example, they have the patrollers. So the patrollers are ants that are responsible for taking care and protecting the colony.
Okay.
So they are also more aggressive because their job's like, okay, you're so weird, I'm going to get you. You're not going to mess up with my colony. So this is kind of what they do.
And who do the patrollers patrol against? Because we're too big to patrol against.
Yeah, they can patrol like against other ants, termites, anything that might be a threat to the ant. To the ant colony.
Okay, so that's patrollers.
Yeah. But when we also talk about personality, some people study personality regarding the whole ant colony.
Okay.
So it's interesting to see that because we had in the lab at the time, we had around 12 ant colonies of leafcutters.
Okay.
And they were very different from each other.
Really? How?
Yeah. So some of them, like, they would be very, they would eat very fast when we give them leaves. Some of them would always be running away if they have an opportunity.
Oh, okay.
So it was kind of funny because
you mean as a unit or subdivisions within each?
Yeah, like we talk about the whole colony because it's really hard for us to identify ant individually.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened? Like, I'm gonna give you. I think it's a funny example, but I'll try to explain.
Okay.
So my lab, we had. At the time, I convinced my advisor to name all the ant colonies after pop divas.
Oh, okay.
So I could tell people that I was working with pop divas.
Right, and like, I'm working with Beyonce and Taylor Swift and
Shakira. Yeah, uh-huh. So it was kind of this.
Okay.
And it did work. I mean, he was, for a second, I thought he was like, no, Mila, because before he used to name all of them as scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, okay, are we having a Madonna? I was like, yes, we can have Madonna, so it was great.
Okay.
And
so he was on board as long as there was one that was called Madonna.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So we did this and we named the colonies. And the fun thing, for example, Shakira, the colony, was the most aggressive in a way that they were very powerful. Like, they used to like eat a lot, to have to give them extra food, and they will try to run away all the time. So what happened, like, we keep them in these boxes, and there's like a product here that blocks for them from going up, and but the Shakira colony would try so hard to run away all the time that eventually they would remove part of that and they would go out.
Wow.
So they would like
they're running amok in the lab.
Yeah. And then someone will call us and like, hey, the ants are like in the middle of the hallway. And I was like, no. And I would have to come and like grab the ants and be like, you have everything you need to live here.
Except life is freedom.
Easy. Life is easy. Don't go away. Like, one time that colony, that was the day that I got really like, I was like, this is insane. I can't believe that's happening.
Uh-huh.
They run away and they went through the to the sink and they went outside. The plumbing system, and they were taking flowers from the tree outside. So it was like that happens, I think, in often. No, it's spring there in Brazil, and we have like near the biology institute, we have a bunch of these trees that gets like these tiny yellow flowers.
Sure.
So the floor, it's very beautiful because basically the floor is filled with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was watching them coming back, and I was like, oh my God, they ran away again. And then I started looking, I was like, where did you find this yellow flower? And I was like, no, that's not possible. And then I started looking, they were going outside. I was like, how? So yeah, personality, you know, like,
wow.
Not every colony does that. I mean, does it say a lot? It could be like related to a lot of different things. Really hard to explain personality.
But they have a collective consciousness. They're like, if we work together, we can knock this thing open and we can bust out of this joint. Wow.
And they had food, just to acknowledge that. They had food and they were running away to get the flowers. I was like, I hate you.
And they're like,
mutual.
You're killing me. You're killing me. So that's the Shakira one. So would you say there was one that was did you have like a kind of hippie mellow ant colony versus the super aggressive ones?
Yeah, honestly, the one that we called Florence, because of Florence and the Machine, it was a very chill colony.
Okay, so they're just like kicking back, you know, smoking a doobie or whatever they do.
Just
the
chilling.
Ant version of a doobie.
They would do their thing, but just chilling. Never, like, well-behaved kids. Okay. It was basically this.
Now, what happens if you take ants from the different colonies that were where it's clearly delineated what the colony personality is, and you mix them together, what happens?
Yeah, so this is one of the coolest things about colony, is that they really can tell the difference between what's different from them.
Mm-hmm.
So they attack everything. So like if you put ants from different colonies together, I mean, it can vary a little bit with the species. Some species are more aggressive than others. Mm-hmm. But in general, like, they attack each other. So there's a lot of conflict between not only like within the nest, because sometimes that happens because it's a lot of things going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of conflict between ant species and between ant nests from the same species.
Wow.
Because they can tell the difference.
That's in, okay, so.
They smell different, like a little bit different.
Sure.
So that's how they tell.
So when ants encounter another ant that doesn't smell like them, they're like, it's on. there's no like maybe let's try and work together.
Yeah, in general, it depends a little bit of what kind of ant. Like, mm-hmm. for example, if it is a patroller, they might like go for attack immediately.
Sure. Okay.
Others no, and it also depends a little bit. I mean, this is like my general observations about the conditions. Like, if they're alone and they just found like a bunch of other ants from a different nest, they might not engage.
Sure, because.
But if they're not, they probably will.
That's crazy. Yeah. So you talked about patroller ants, and you talked about the division. So what are the other divisions within the ant communities?
Mm-hmm. So when we think about like the general tasks, uh-huh. we have the foragers who go outside and look for food.
Okay.
The patrollers are the ones that protect the colony. Mm-hmm. We have what we call like the nurses. So they take care of the babies and the ant babies. And we have the queen. Mm-hmm. And the queen only job is to lay eggs. Some people think that the queen somehow controls the colony, but that doesn't happen. Like, it's basically like just the reproductive system of the colony.
Mm-hmm.
Just one queen.
Laying all the eggs.
Yeah, some species have more than one queen. For example, leafcutters is usually one queen that can have like 8 million ants at that time. And the crazy thing about them is that the life of a colony is mm-hmm. measured by the life of the queen.
Okay.
And it can live up like more than 20 years. And each ant lives 1 year. So one thing that amazes me is that how many eggs, like how many ants?
Yeah.
Isn't that insane? It's just like...
So how many eggs does the queen just lay eggs every day or
all the time.
Like she's just an egg. She's like a Pez dispenser. She's just shooting out eggs. Boom, 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 boom.
That
boom.
One has a tough life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And so is the queen ant bigger than the other ants?
Yeah.
So it's obvious when you're looking at an ant colony who the queen is.
Yeah.
And is the queen, where do they physically house the queen within? Is the queen like at the center or can she be anywhere?
It can vary a little bit. For the leafcutters ant, one thing that is important is that they cultivate fungi.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a species, they take the leaves outside
and
they bring them inside the nest, and they don't feed on the leaves. They feed, they give the leaves to the fungus. This fungus like consumes these leaves and then they eat the fungus.
Okay.
So some ants also like take some sugars in the leaf when they're cutting. So this is also part of their like feeding, but mostly that's the system. It's what we call a symbiosis when we have a relationship that's good for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
So the ants keep the fungus clean with no like other type of diseases, anything. They like do this big part mm-hmm. of taking care of the fungus, and the fungus gives them food.
Okay.
So
it's like they're gardening.
Yeah, yeah. We call them agriculture, actually.
Nice.
So another thing that I think is pretty cool, because we think that we are the ones that do agriculture, but mm-hmm. even ants do it.
That's amazing. So with the queen, does she just have one mate, or does she mate with a bunch of different ants all the time? Is she constantly mating and producing eggs, mating and producing eggs?
Yeah, so this is also really cool. Usually they have one mate event,
mm-hmm.
but it can be like a lot of different like males. So,
okay.
like, it depends a lot
wait,
of...
Wait, wait, wait. Usually they have one, but sometimes...
Yeah, it's one unique event, mm-hmm. but in this unique event, the queen, like, is fecundated, like, with a great range of males. So what really happens, like, we have a colony.
Mm-hmm.
This colony is ready to reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts producing some reproductive individuals, because most ants are not. They are not fertile. So
how do they, convert ants into reproductive ants, or are they born reproductive?
For ants, it's such a vast thing. There's always a species. So there are species that do that, like a worker can become... can be able to become reproductive.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, for the leafcutters, no. The new ants, they are born, they are ready to fly. They also are the ones that have wings, because they will fly away to reproduce and found a new colony.
Wait, 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 wait. There are ants that fly?
Yes. That's why they're insects. It's one of the reasons.
I don't think I've ever seen a flying ant in my life.
Yeah, because that's it. Like, they only fly when they're going to reproduce. So basically what happens is that the queen, it comes, it flies, finds a place, and she's like, okay, this looks like a nice place to start a colony. And then she releases an hormone, a pheromone, actually, that invites a lot of males to reproduce with her. Then she reproduces with a bunch of males, and then she removes her wings. And then she starts, like, creating the nest. So it's really hard for her to, like, create a nest because she stays, like, until she has enough ants to take care of the fungi, everything. Like, it's basically her doing everything, looking for food, just resting. It's funny because for the leafcutters, she eats a little bit of the original fungi, like the original fungus. And then when she's ready to create her colony, she poops that fungi. Then she takes care and grow it enough. Then she starts laying eggs. And that's what she does for the rest of her life, just lay eggs.
So how long does it take from the time a queen finds a new compound, I'll call it, like, because it's like I'm thinking like she's starting her own cult. That's how I'm envisioning it in my head. So she flies off, she lands, she's like, this looks nice, this looks nice. She starts putting out a pheromone. How far does that pheromone travel for other ants to smell it, number one? And then how long does it take to get to the point where the queen can just now focus on having, you know, laying eggs?
Yeah, first about, like, the pheromone, I have no idea how long that spreads. But one thing that it's important is that when they're having, like, the thing that we call the nuptial flight, when all the reproductive individuals fly away, it's a lot of individuals. So, like, it's thousands and thousands of them. And all this kind of happens at the same time for different species. For the same species, like from different colonies.
Okay.
So there's a lot of ants around to smell it. So I think that also that also helps.
Okay.
So they have, like, the system. And then what was the other question?
Then how long, once she's found a place to go, before she's able to just focus on producing eggs?
Yeah. That's also a hard question because it depends a lot on the conditions.
Okay. Like,
the success of creating, founding a new colony, a new successful colony that's gonna, like, reproduce again, it's really low. Like, I remember something that for, like, 10,000 females, less than 100's gonna found a colony that's gonna be. Most of them die. Like, imagine you're just an ant. A bird comes, it's done. It's gone.
Right. Right.
It's hard.
Yes. Like, I'm walking across the street. Oops, there goes the colony.
Yeah. Like, it's really hard. But usually, like, in the lab, once they are done, like, we start, like, they start growing. We used to, like, start using them for experiments. Around, like, 3 years old at least.
Okay.
So I think, because then it would be, like, a little bit grown. So I would estimate that, depending on the size, like, for them to stop doing the thing, I think, it, like, less than a year.
Oh, okay.
For them to when they're going to succeed, because it's really hard. Like, sometimes she's not able to take care of everything.
Right.
But until the colony reproduces again, usually it takes, like, around 5 years.
What happens if...
But it varies a lot. Just, you know, like, there's around 18,000 species of ants all over the world.
Okay.
And basically, you can find whatever you look for. Like, there's always an exception.
Sure, sure, sure. What happens... like, let's say there's construction and an ant colony gets disrupted. What then happens to that, like, they go off and look, but what happens if the queen is destroyed during a disruption of the colony?
If the queen dies, the colony is fated to die.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You mean once the queen is gone, that's it? That's all she wrote?
Yeah, because the thing is that all ants, they live around a year.
Okay.
And then there's no new ants. So after that event, in less than a year, usually the colony dies.
Can you introduce a new queen to that colony, or will it just not work?
Yeah, because the thing is, like, remember I mentioned that they attack each other from colonies, so it's pretty hard.
So they would,
like,
just cannibalize her for parts or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Mila Pamplona Barbosa about ants and their circadian rhythms and their neurophysiology. Let's talk about that. Yes. So what is it when you're talking about ant neurophysiology, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so also when we think about I think it's important to explain a little bit about our circadian clock. Mm-hmm. So then I think it's easier to understand why I was studying ants.
Okay.
Because it did make sense. Mm-hmm. So for us, for us to be live in sync with the environment, we mm-hmm. need to get the cues of the light dark cycle, basically if it's day or night.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens that we see the light outside, this light, part of this light is going to be processed, for example, to create a vision. So you're going to form image,
mm-hmm.
but part of this light is not going to be processed in our brain to create an image. It's going to be processed in a part of our brain called suprachiasmatic nuclei.
Okay.
And then in this part of brain, what happens is that they start pulsing, neurons, they pulse, they have this potential, electric potential,
mm-hmm.
and they start doing that in sync, and then stimulate then the pineal gland that produces melatonin.
Oh, okay.
So that's when melatonin is done, and melatonin tells the rest of the body that it's night. This is important because a lot of people think melatonin is just a sleep hormone, but mm-hmm. melatonin tells when it's night.
Okay.
So if you're diurnal, your melatonin is mostly expressed during the night. That's why we think it's related to sleep. But if you are a nocturnal animal, it's also during the night. But melatonin is super important. It mm-hmm. tells the body this organization of time, it makes all the little organs, everything work together in sync. And that's
okay.
super important because if you're not in sync, then you get sick. People that work night shifts,
mm-hmm.
a lot of them, they invert this. They eat at times that our body is not ready to get food.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's really disturbing for the physiology and the health.
Sure.
So they're more likely to have diabetes, cardiovascular diseases,
mm-hmm.
depression, a lot of things. And so what I'm really interested in, it's how these things are connected, how we connect this information that goes between all the cells, all the mm-hmm. little things in our body or our organs, and makes everything work right. And the reason why I studied the ants is because I wanted to see that, how this connection between the little parts creates something that collective works and in sync.
Okay.
So what's that?
So I want to go back to just make sure I understand about the melatonin. So the melatonin itself is not what's making you sleepy. The melatonin is simply sending a signal that says, hey, it's nighttime. And if you are a daytime creature, then you would sleep. But if you're a nighttime creature, the melatonin is a signal to, hey, time to get up. Is that correct?
Yeah. What happens, this is a little bit complicated because it goes to the chemistry of how it's produced,
mm-hmm.
but light inhibits one of the molecules that it's used to create melatonin.
Okay.
So basically you only have melatonin when it's night because of that, because you don't have the light inhibiting it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's why people who use devices at night, it throws off their circadian rhythms.
Yes.
So let's talk about that.
Yeah, sure.
Throwing off the circadian rhythms of an ant. What does that happen?
Yeah, that's what I did in my master's.
Oh, okay.
The thing that opened the doors for me to come to Stanford.
So what did you do?
When people travel between different time zones,
yes.
and they have a jet lag.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what I did is I made a colony jet lag.
Okay.
In the lab.
Uh-huh. How did you do that?
When you change the lights,
uh-huh.
so you can have a cycle that is 12 hours of light, 12 hours of dark.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, that goes from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Okay.
But then if we switch that, you change, for example, to noon to midnight, then you're creating a jet lag.
Okay.
So I did exactly this with my aunts, and it was really funny because they really got confused. It was so exciting for me to see. I was like, this
uh-huh.
is working.
Now how did that confusion manifest itself?
Yeah, you can see that they're the way that they're foraging changed a little bit.
In what way?
They were not foraging when they were supposed to do it, and
uh-huh.
so you can see that there was some kind of confusion there.
Uh-huh.
But after a few days, they resynchronize again.
And
that's
okay.
exactly what happens with us.
So when you say they resynchronize, are you saying that they, as a group of ants, get back into sync with each other, or are you saying they just? Because it sounds like when they were jet lagged, they were all moving at different rates within the colony.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
And so when they get back into sync, that's when they're like, okay, now we get it.
Yeah.
And then did you throw them off again just to be spiteful?
Yeah. So when we did this throwing, the thing that we can see, like I measured two things.
Mm-hmm.
One was foraging behavior. So mm-hmm. basically the ant trail, how many ants were there. That's why I had to develop a software to count ants.
Okay.
Which was really hard.
Okay.
So it might sound simple, but I spent like 5 years doing that.
They're tiny.
It
how
was
can
really
you possibly,
hard.
You know, I yeah. lose count with regular things. So.
Yes. And then I also measure the amount of leaves that they were cutting.
Okay.
As a property, like, okay, this is the general energy that they're coming, that they're taking
mm-hmm.
in the colony. So what we see is that after the phase shift, after a few days, usually when they're in sync, for the leaf cutter ants, they are mostly active during the night. So mm-hmm. we have like huge foraging trails in the night, but we still have foraging during the day, but it's low. And also like, because we have so many ants during the night, there's also the moment that they cut more.
Mm-hmm.
But during the day, they also cut. But proportionally, the amount that they cut during the day with this little amount of ants, it's higher than what they cut when we think about this huge amount of ants.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also like a trade-off of efficiency here. What they're doing during the day, it's different than what they do during the night. So what I saw when I did the jet lag is that I saw first in the few days a mess between these two patterns
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
of which one is more efficient, when we have more ants, when they're cutting more. And then after a few days, we kind of recovered that. So we see that... they're back on track. Like, again, okay. It's the natural instinct pattern that they cut more during the night, but they have much more ants. Mm-hmm. So proportionally, they're not super effective then. And during the day, much less ants, but they also cut. And proportionally, it's more efficient then.
So in that time when it was more chaotic, would you see ants sort of waiting around, like that disruption and that confusion in an ant, how, like, when I'm tired, you know, maybe I'm not as efficient, like someone's waiting for something that I can't give mm-hmm. them. So is there, or is there more aggression, or mm-hmm. is there, you know, those yeah. types of things?
Yeah. I didn't measure specific these things.
But did you observe?
But it? I observed that. So okay. it was really funny because they were really confused. Like, they sometimes would like have a, like carry a leaf and go like, multiple times carrying the leaf without coming back to the nest, or just like stop for a long time.
Oh.
Like, what's happening? So it was really funny. Like, they also, like, they were a little bit more stressed. So mm-hmm. they were trying to run away more often, some mm-hmm. of them. So you can see that they were like, what's happening? This is not what's supposed to happen now.
So how much time above ground do leaf cutter ants spend? Because it sounds like, you know, they're deeply buried
yeah.
in the ground.
So this is also one of the cool things to associate with us, because
mm-hmm.
not all cells in our body are sensitive to light.
Uh-huh.
Like, we don't process light with, like, I don't know, like our feet or like
right,
whatever.
Right.
It's just like basically our eyes and the way that we receive that.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like for the ants, it's kind of the same thing. Like, we have this huge part of ants. The major part of the colony is underground in constant darkness. They will never see light.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a part of ants that go outside to look for food, to patrol, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. they receive this light cues, and they come down and they synchronize this to everyone.
I was going to ask. So
it's
that's
basically
how
what happens with us.
Oh.
Like, this is also, I think it's really beautiful because it's like nature repeats itself. So you
okay.
don't need to spend every, like, when you have a system that is mm-hmm. like for ants and other social insects, people sometimes call them the super organism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like we need to spend all the resources doing one thing. Maybe we do like a little bit, but that's enough to like send the information to the whole body.
So is it that the ants that never come above ground, they get the signal or the food that's like, oh, they're back. It must be daytime. Time to eat. Is that what triggers the hormonal release?
Yeah, this is something that we're not 100% sure yet.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that we have these changes of how much of them are going away forage. So I think this is also an important cue.
Okay.
It's also important. It's possible that their pheromones change somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that ants, they work with a lot of recruiting. So basically, if an ant go and it calls a friend, and then this friend call another friend, and then they become like this big network. So if they're more active naturally, like at night, they might be able to reach and have interactions with more ants and recruit even more to go to be active. So I think that kind of like happens, but it's hard to explain because as it's a very complex system.
Right. So you're saying that the ants that go foraging, they might come back and whatever in however they're communicating with other ants might make it seem like a very desirable thing to go out into the light and come back.
Yeah, it's like what they do, for example, when they find a new source of food. Mm-hmm. Like if it's a good source, they see that it's nutritional, they come back, they invite other ants, and then those ants go, and then they start cutting.
Okay.
Like, for example, when it's for the leaf cutter, and leaf cutters, they do this. Like, the first one usually is not the first one that cuts. Mm-hmm. It goes, finds the food, come back, marking the trail, come like, hey, friends, I found the food, let's go. They go, and then they cut, and they come back. And when they come back, other ones see, oh, my God, you guys found new food. Let's go for it. And then everyone goes.
Wow. So then, you know, we as humans, we don't like finding ants in our home. So we're constantly, you know, like, and ants will make their way in there for any number of reasons. And of course, we decimate them. So do the colonies kind of notice when ants don't come back? Or is it just like, you know, business as usual? Like, you know, maybe the queen puts out a new, but you know, 10,000 ants, and they don't even really notice.
Yeah, this is gonna be sad to say, but basically they just keep going.
Okay.
But it also depends a lot on the species and the size of the colony. Mm-hmm. So for colonies that are much smaller, it's more likely for the colony to feel an impact of losing ants. Like you have colonies that can have like hundreds of individuals. This is a very small colony when you're comparing to other ones. Mm-hmm. So I think that that changed a little bit. But one thing, there are some papers on that. That somehow, like you, for example, if you remove all the patrollers, and then first there's a dynamic. So a lot of foragers start doing the patroller's job.
Okay.
Because it keeps, and then I don't know how, but then like a lot of the next eggs are patrollers.
Okay.
So I don't know if they somehow do this. If it was like, I haven't seen, I don't know if this experiment has been like replicated multiple times and not in like, I don't remember even the species, but they have some kind of control to know what they need.
Right.
I think it's pretty cool.
We don't have enough patrollers. We need, you know.
Someone got to do the job. Come on.
Got it. So in your research, what is something that you have discovered or have observed that surprised you or amazed you or delighted you that you didn't know before you started the research?
That's a really good question because I didn't know anything about ants. So a lot of,
but you liked them and you knew a little bit.
Yeah. But I think one of the things that I really liked about it, it's to see that they could be this system that we can manipulate and see effects in large scale.
Okay.
Because, for example, for the jet lag experiment, when we do this with a rodent or like with a human, we can see like the behavior, we can measure a few things, but it's really hard to see like how things happen in a scale. With the ants, we could see a lot of that. And I thought it was really cool to see that they change the pattern of efficiency when they are jet lag, because that reveals at some level that there's an energetic cost to keep you in sync. So it's not the same thing. It's a completely different organism, but it's very similar to who works in work shifts. Like it's harder for you. Like a lot of people eat more when they are working only during the night because they're hungry and then their body is not related to that. So it's a stress of not living in sync.
Right.
So it's really, to me, it's beautiful despite being sad, but it's beautiful to see that how much energy is important to tell the story. So not only like about ants and behavior and a lot of things in nature, but also how we live our lives, like the way that energy flows, like as the way that I talk about like, the energy that you need to survive, like your cells and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important. It tells a lot of stories.
So you work with massive quantities of ants. And are there ever times when it just sometimes creeps you out because there's so many of them and just one of you?
Honestly, that went away.
Oh, but there have been times when you're just like, this is too much. Like when you were talking about scooping up ants and trying to bring them back.
Yeah, at the beginning that happened.
Uh-huh.
Especially because I had to learn how to take care of them.
Okay.
And for example, to experience if the fungi was healthy,
uh-huh.
we needed to touch it. So I need to like put the hand there. So it was really, really tough. I remember that I did that and I was so scared. I was like, all the ants climbing over you. It's scary, but eventually it goes away. I think with time, the ants are not so scary. People mm-hmm. are more scary than they should. Unless you have allergies, then I get it. But ants are fine. Like with time, it's like I used to hold them in my hand and mm-hmm. I could even like mark them if mm-hmm. I needed for an experiment.
Oh, okay.
And they'll be fine. You understand them. You respect like their pace. It's funny because the leaf cutters, they have like their mouths is basically like a little scissor.
Mm-hmm.
So they really cut you. Like, like if I used to do stuff with like you wearing gloves, sometimes they would bite the glove. I would try to remove them and I would like decapitate them.
Oh,
and
no.
they would still be like really strong, like biting me back because of the electric stings. I'm like, girl, it wasn't that's on you.
Yeah.
You kept doing this. I was trying to take care.
Yeah. I was trying to give you a break, but hey, gotta go. And then the reason I ask is because like I'm generally afraid of bugs, but
that's fair.
But like butterflies and ladybugs, I'm okay with them, but still a large group of them, I'm still like, ugh. So even someone like you who's very experienced dealing with bugs, it still seems like when you talk about 8 million of them, you know, and then like getting out. And I just sort of imagine like a giant black mass, just sort of like a giant censored line. Just
it
moving.
Is like this, like ugh. This collective behavior is of, I mean, I think there's a little bit of scare when it's too much of anything.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
But to me, like in general, I'm fine with them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then we're almost out of time and this is fascinating. And I know there are people out there who didn't even realize just how fascinating ants were. What like you mentioned like a YouTube videos or what would you recommend for people who are interested in the behavior of ants to either view online or a book that they should mm-hmm. look at?
Yeah, I think on YouTube there's a lot of really good stuff about ants.
Mm-hmm.
There's this website called it's not a website, it's like a channel that's mm-hmm. really big called Ants Canada.
Ants Canada?
Yeah, and it's basically a guy who raises ants. There's a lot of people out there that want to like do farms of ants at
mm-hmm,
home.
Mm-hmm.
And he does like with different species and he teaches and he shows like take care. A lot of people love it. There's like millions of subscribers.
Okay.
And it's definitely fun. I also like a lot of videos. I don't remember the name of the channel, but mm-hmm. if you look like Ant World War or something like this, it's a bunch of animations talking about different species of ants
mm-hmm.
and they're really pretty animations and it's so funny. It's like this World War ants, I think it's between termites and ants, and it's narrated in a very fun way.
Okay.
So they have like a bunch of series on that and they're really cool.
And when little kids come up to you and they ask, what do? How do you explain it to a little kid what you do?
This is a good question, too, because I think I'm switching. Now I'm going to study glass frogs, so I don't know how I'm going to answer that question in the future.
Yeah.
But I tell them I'm a scientist and that I love animals, and I try to understand why they do what they do and how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I really like to understand if they sleep at night or sleep during the day.
Okay.
And how that happens. Because I did this, like, I did some outreach that I had, like, I brought the ant colony and I was, like, with a bunch of 5 years old. And I was like, don't touch the colony, don't touch the ants. But teaching about them was cool.
Yeah, because they might squeeze them and then there goes your research.
Can you imagine? I was more worried about their getting bite and someone have an emerging, like, allergic reaction, I'll be like, oh God, 20 kids.
So one of the things we've learned is that you can be allergic to ants, because that's what I'm gathering from this.
Yeah, some people can. My brother is very allergic to
ants. Oh, wow. Yeah. So do you ever like just torture him? It's like, if you don't stop annoying me, I got these ants.
Yeah, I didn't, but because I've seen he has like big reactions.
Oh, okay.
In my case, I have been bitten for so much stuff that my parents were like, oh, is this coming again? And they're like, no, okay, Mila's fine.
Well, on that, Mila, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was such a great conversation. Yeah. I love talking about science and ants. I think it's just so cool.
Well, I like having scientists on like you guys, because you're always so passionate about what you do that it makes it interesting to listen to.
Yeah.
All right. People of Earth, ants. That's right, ants. And Mila will be surprised to learn you're not the first person who's been on the show who's talked about ants.
Yeah.
You're like the second one.
Ooh.
But the first one was a long time ago, so I'm glad to revisit the ant colony,
oh,
as we say.
Oh, that's cool.
All right, people of Earth, Mr. Ford is here. He'll be pleasuring your ear hole. I'm going to, of course you know, I have to play James Brown. I'm going to play I Got Ants in My Pants and a Need to Dance. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta. And toodly-doo.
Ah! Hey! Tell me what you're gonna do.